Hello and welcome to Thinking Poker Podcast. I'm Andrew Brokus. He's Nate Mavis. And are things starting to return to normal in Somerville, Nate?
Things are returning to normal, and I'm happy about that. Welcome to episode 29, listeners.
Yes, a return to normalcy on the podcast. And a very exciting show. It's the return of Tommy Angelo today to talk about his book, Elements of Poker, which we've been reading all this month for the book club. Although I think even if you have not been reading along, you're going to enjoy this because it's freaking Tommy Angelo, man.
I think he is our most requested guest.
With good reason.
Yeah, we give the people what they want.
So. That's what we want too, conveniently.
Yes. Yeah, especially when we also want it.
So. The first time we had him on here, our second episode, and we said, this was the reason we started the show is we'd have an excuse to talk to not just people like Tommy Angelo, but specifically Tommy Angelo, and that if we never did another episode, we'd both be satisfied with it. But I'm glad that we did enough episodes that we had an excuse to invite him back.
Yeah. I think this must mean we're getting worse at podcasting because we started, and then it only took us two episodes to get Tommy. And then it took us 27 more episodes to get Tommy again. So,
and everything in between was just a waste.
Yeah, I mean, I shudder to think of how long it's going to take us to get to talk to Tommy yet again.
That's 2 years.
Yeah, very bad. So Sticky Soft sent us a hand this week. You want to talk about the hand?
Yeah. This strategy segment is sponsored by Tournament Poker Edge. And if you enjoy the strategy talk that we have regularly on this show, then you really ought to go check out tournamentpokeredge.com. It's $30 a month, even cheaper if you sign up by the quarter or by the year, and you'll get unlimited access to their library of strategy videos, which you can stream, you can download. There's plenty of opportunities to hear me talk strategy at length. You can watch videos by Daryl Jace, Big Dog Pocket Fives, Mike Leah, lots of great players who have or are currently making videos for them. And there's also a very active community on there. Gareth actually has been posting a few hands. He and I have had some hand discussion on there along with some of the other members and pros. So it's also a chance to hear some more strategy or read some more strategy from Gareth. You can post your own questions. You can get feedback on hands that you played, both from other members and from pros, including myself. And it's just a great place all around to improve your game. So I encourage you to get started today at tournamentpokeredge.com. So this comes from, he describes himself as an amateur playing in the WSOP 2012 main event, which he clarifies as event 61.
Very useful.
He says this is on day two, and the blinds are 300, 600, 75. He didn't have any reads other than, I guess, having played with these guys for 2 hours, which the chip leader appears to be a pretty tight player since he has seen very few flops.
Solid information.
So here's in the big blind with 27,000 chips, so 45 big blinds. And the chip leader, this tight player who hasn't seen that many flops, is in the small blind. It's folded around to the button, who has a stack of about 54,000. And he opens for 1,500, 2.5 big blinds. The small blind, 3 bets to 4,000. And Hero is in the big blind with pocket aces.
So I have one thing that I really want to know now. Can I state the obvious?
We need to know how often the button's been opening.
Well, we do need to know that. Well, that's even less obvious. We need to know what our own image is, because if a tight player 3-bets the small blind, like, there are a lot of tight people who aren't routinely attacking button raises. So a lot of people will have a good range, like a strong range, for even making this kind of a 3-bet. And since Hero only has a little bit less than 7 times, has 6.75 times the size of the 3-bet, if he has even any reason to think that you might be a little bit spewy, you really have to stick it in and try to get called preflop.
Yeah, I mean, with this stack size, you just don't have that many options with this kind of action in front of you. I mean, I guess obviously we're ruling out folding. So the question is, do we cold call? Do we 4-bet less than all in, or do we 4-bet all in? You know, those are really your options. And if less than all in, we'd have to talk about exactly how much. The problem, I think, with 4-betting less than all in is that it's really hard to make it seem like you have anything other than a huge hand, no matter how much you four bet. I don't think anyone is going to believe that you're intending on folding to a shove if you four bet small. I mean, no matter what you four bet, I think it's going to be pretty clear that you have a hand that you believe is worth 27,000 chips.
Yes.
So, given that you're going to give away that information anyway, I think there's not a lot of reason why you shouldn't just put all your money in there. In fact, it's as what I think you were getting at, Nate, it's probably going to look weaker than making a smaller four bet. I mean,
Maybe even cold calling.
I don't know. I think that I would actually probably cold call here before I would make a small four bet. Although I'm really not a big fan of cold calling in this spot. I just think it's unnecessary. Like there's a lot of money in the pot already. And if you shove here, you're not going to get action from just anything, but you don't have to. There's a lot of money in the pot already. If both of them fold, that's not the end of the world. I mean, I think, so I guess I'll tell you that the hero here four bets to 8,000. And he does it after thinking for a really long time, which I think also is going to tend to look strong. He says someone actually calls the clock on him, which, yeah, I
Must
mean,
have been at least like 3 minutes then, probably.
most likely, or he's been doing this a lot. And
Yeah.
people are like fed up with it, but I don't get the sense that that's the case. So yeah, I mean, I think the like thinking for a long time and then raising is a pretty well-known tale of having a strong hand. And I also think making a really small four bet is an extremely strong thing. The hero in the sand actually says that based on the chip leader's three bet from the small blind and his seemingly tight play, he says he's putting him on ace king suited, aces, kings, queens, or jacks. That seems pretty tight to me for three betting a button opener, even if the guy has been on the tight side. I wouldn't be so quick to put him on such a strong range. But that said, I really don't see him folding many, if any, of those hands to a shove here. So if that's what you think his range is, I really see no reason to four bet small rather than just shove it in. I mean, is he really gonna fold kings or queens or jacks is the only one I could see him like maybe going into the tank and folding with, but even that seems kind of unlikely to me.
Yeah, especially because Sticky Soft, who's the guy who emailed us, did not tell us how many chips this person has, just describes him as the chip leader at the
Well, no,
table. Given
he
that
says
this
he
is
has
the.
four times here at stack, so a little over
Oh,
100.
sorry. Okay, I was going to guess 90K. So more than that. But especially, he's not going to. If he's got that many chips, there's a good chance he's just going to shrug and call with jacks. So,
Yeah,
or even like tens. So.
once you put him on that strong of a range, I think there's really no question but to shove. I mean, you get all the money in there now versus and what ends up happening. Here he makes his four bet to 8,000. The button folds. The small blind calls. So now the pot is 18K. Hero has 19K, and the flop comes ace deuce three. So now we're at a scenario where this player might end up folding a hand like queens or jacks. I can imagine myself in the small blind shoes saying to me, "Wow, that four bet was fishy as hell." Or I mean, suspicious, not necessarily bad. It was suspicious as hell. I'm going to call mostly to set mine, and see what happens after the flop. And doing that with a hand as strong as like queens.
Yeah.
And there may be some flops where I'm not able to get away from queens, but this is a flop where I might. Whereas if you had just shoved pre-flop, even if I didn't feel great about it, I'm going to be calling with queens. So this is an example of why you might feel like, oh, I'm stringing him along. I'm getting him to put 4,000 more in, and then maybe he'll feel committed on the flop. But with all the hands that you're talking about him having, he's going to feel committed pre-flop anyway, and it's better to get the money in now while you still have the nuts, while he still has the second or the third or the fourth nuts, hopefully, rather than waiting until the flop when something exactly like this could happen, where the villain is no longer going to feel strong about his hand.
Yeah, and the villain is not super likely to have a small pocket pair. I think a lot of these people would just call out of the small blind with a hand like fours, but you really don't want to give somebody a correct set mind when the alternative is to either make them put it all in pre-flop or fold. I mean, probably he's just going to fold fours to a jam, but and I'm not saying you're giving him a correct set mind, but you're getting close to giving him a correct set mind if you four bet to 8,000.
Yeah,
So.
he's really not going to be making that big of a mistake to call a small four bet. I mean, it'd be a bit of a mistake, but you're not actually winning that much more by stringing him along with a weak hand for 4,000 more chips when the pot is already so large pre-flop.
I also like what you said, Andrew, about calling with queens as a sort of set mine, just because it brings us back to something we talked about last week, which is that there's not a really sharp distinction always between set mining and not set mining. And here I'm thinking about your hand at the Borgata, where you faced a three bet of an early position raise from early position and a cold call with queens, and you called. And it wasn't exactly that you were just set mining. And on the driest flops, you know, you weren't just looking to fold over pairs, but you were just very willing to fold an over pair to the wrong kind of action and with the wrong kind of board texture, where you weren't ahead of enough of your opponent's likely hands.
Yeah, and I think proceeding with caution.
It's not just like, I think with some people, I think I fall into this sometimes, proceeding with caution actually just means calling and then getting scared. Like, just like, okay, it's like, I don't know, I'm just going to experience some fear and then call. That's not good. I mean, calling is not a compromise, as a wise person has written. And also, like you want to have a plan. And I think for myself, I sometimes make too sharp of a distinction between, okay, here's a situation where I'm going to proceed strongly with a lot of overpairs, and here's a situation where I have a pure set mine with a hand that 5 minutes ago I thought was a value hand. So like a hand like nines, where I'm playing it strongly pre-flop because it's a great hand. And then, oh, look, somebody shows value. Okay, now I have a set mining hand. You know, there's another situation that's kind of proceeding with caution phase, where you can be ready to fold an overpair, even if it's wrong sometimes, but also, yeah.
Yeah, or ready to fold top pair. I mean, when I say proceed with caution, what I mean really is I might end up getting a good flop and still folding. Like, I'm considering that a very realistic possibility, where I'm calling mostly because I'm getting really good odds pre-flop, but my spidey sense is tingling, and I'm prepared to let go of the hand, even in what seems like a pretty good flop for me. So if I call a three bet with ace queen, it may be with the intention of possibly like calling one bet on a sideboard and folding to continued action, or just looking for some show of weakness from my opponent that indicates maybe I'm good after all. But if I don't get that sign, I may well be giving up later in the hand.
Yeah. And I think maybe I'm just sensitive to it because it's something I've been working on over the last year or two. But I think it's good to recognize that when you have a big pair before the flop and you start to worry, you know, there is a middle way between over pairs are the nuts and pure set mine. There are other things, which yeah. is just what the math would tell you, but it's a good thing to remember.
Yeah. And so I feel like the central preflop mistake that our hero is making here is he's really only thinking about his own hand. He's thinking like, I have aces and I have to get some more. I have to get more out of it, you know, and he's not really thinking about a value target. He's not thinking about what am I trying to get called by, he mentions what he thinks the small blind's range is, but I don't think that his play is really consistent with what would be the best thing to do if he actually believes the small blind has that range. Like, I feel like what he's thinking is just, I have to get a little more money in this pot, but I don't want to scare anyone away. And you know, if you actually think that through and say, well, is he going to get scared away if he has kings or queens or even jacks or ace king? Quite possibly not. So I certainly wouldn't expect a player I didn't know that much about in the WSOP to be folding ace king or jacks if I called jammed here. And so I think that's really what you just your instinct. You should be looking for an excuse to put more money into the pot when you have aces, not an excuse to put less in. So really the question should be, you know, unless I have a good reason not to shove, that's what I'm going to do. And there are often good reasons not to shove, like there would be a huge overbet of the pot. But here, it's a perfectly reasonable spot to shove aces, and I just don't see any reason to do anything other than that.
I think we should talk about some things that Sticky Soft did well, because we've given him a hard time so far.
Okay.
And spoiler alert, the flop, we're probably going to give him a hard time again.
Yeah, although that one he acknowledges that he made a mistake. I mean, I think that's where he thinks his mistake happened.
Yeah, okay. So thing one, he's thinking before he acts. That's good. I mean, you don't need to spend so long that your opponents are calling the clock on you. That's not good. But like, he's thinking. He's attempting to read his opponent's hand range. That's very good. Like, I think we both think that he's a little bit blinded by his own hand, but you know, I can remember the first time I got aces in the main events. It's pretty exciting that, you know, like he's trying to read, you know, that's very good. I think not cold calling. Probably he was considering cold calling. I think that would be a mistake. So I think he probably for some good reasons rejected one of the bad options. So I think that's good.
Should we say for a second why cold calling is a mistake? Because I mean, obviously there's the like not putting any more money into the pot problem and you know, giving people a chance to draw out on you problem. But I feel like, and you kind of hinted at this earlier, it shows nearly as much strength as shoving does. I mean, clearly no one thinks you're screwing around when you call off 15% of your stack cold with the original razor still to act. You're not going to look terribly weak when you do that anyway. And if you're going to, and this is a spot where you just can't avoid looking strong. I mean, there's already a bet and a re-raise in front of you, and your whole stack is easily at risk. And there's a decent chance people have, whether or not you've said it, people have deduced that you're an amateur playing this tournament. And so anytime you enter a hand when your stack is at risk, people are going to think that you're not screwing around. So you're going to be giving away this information that you have a strong hand no matter what you do. The only question is, are you going to also give your opponents a chance to use that information, which is what you're doing by cold calling? You know, you're saying, I have an extremely strong hand. Now go ahead and see the flop for free or for cheaply and try to outflop my extremely strong hand.
That would be a mistake. Finish the thought. No, I think that's a mistake. And I think in my other point, because I want people to keep emailing the podcast and I don't want to just dump on Sticky Soft, is that Sticky Soft did well to not do that. So I think you're just right. I do want to correct or at least qualify something you said, which is that, you know, once you cold call, everybody knows you're not messing around. I mean, especially if maybe this is an amateur player, maybe this is somebody who looks like he might be getting frustrated. Maybe this is somebody who looks like, you know, like an amateur playing the main event. Like if I came up to you and told you, hey, Andrew, here's a main event story. The button opens and it's the beginning of day two and the small blind three bets. And then the big blind cold calls 15% of his stack. Like, let's say that story ended and the big blind had ace jack suited and the big blind only had sixes, something like that. I mean, would you be shocked? I know I wouldn't be. I mean, it's a mistake, but it's a mistake people make.
Yeah, and that's fair.
Although I don't think that you should be trying really hard to appear like that. I do think that, you know, there are a lot of people who play the main event who just think, yeah, sevens, that's a pair. I have a position. I don't want to get pushed around. 15, yeah, sure, whatever. 4,000. I have all these thousands left. That's okay. You know, I think that happens. And so I don't think you're automatically screaming strength when you do that.
Yeah, that's fair.
Maybe we should talk about the flop.
So we end up, and again, there's now 18K in the pot and 19K in here as stacks. So functionally one pot size bet left behind. And although that doesn't come up in this hand, I think it's worth mentioning that you should really never be folding the flop, no matter how ugly it comes down. And I guess like 10 jack queen all of one suit that's not your suit is about as bad as it could probably come for you. I still don't think you can fold that flop. So I think just you should know that even before you see the flop, is that you're really never getting away from this hand on the flop. The flop, as it happens, comes ace of diamonds, deuce of hearts, three of diamonds. Small blind checks, and the hero says his reaction is one of concern for a flush draw or straight draw.
He put reaction in quotation marks, which makes me think that he thinks he's doing an acting job. Reaction is in quotation marks, and our listeners can decide for themselves what that means. Sorry.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I mean, I'm interrupting your train of thought here.
Well, no. I mean, that's because I was about to go off on why that shouldn't be the first thing you're thinking about. But you're right, because he later says that he thinks maybe he should have checked to show concern for the ace on the flop. Maybe he did. Maybe he is thinking that in terms of acting. That would be better, I think. Okay, so yeah, let's assume that he was not in fact motivated by concern for those things. Although he does go on to say, Hero forgot about the range he put the small blind on. This range precludes the small blind from having a flush draw or straight draw. Maybe not, but in any event.
Yeah, but the ace is one of the two suited cards, so he can't even have an ace king suited.
So. Yeah, so there's really no way that villain could have a straight draw or flush draw. I think that's worth mentioning. It's also worth mentioning that there's a good chance if he has one of those hands, he's probably not, like, A, you don't want him to fold it, and B, he's probably not going to fold it. And since you're not getting away from your hand, even if a diamond comes on, even if the turn is the five of diamonds, I don't think you can fold this. So it doesn't really matter if he has a flush draw. Like, you're not going to make him fold it. You don't want him to fold it, and you're not going to get away from the hand even if he gets there. So yeah, it's just not that big of a deal if he has one of those hands. Like, you've just flopped a huge hand in a spot where, considering what you think he has, it's actually going to be kind of tough for you to get paid off. This is like, even though you flopped the set, I actually consider this like pretty damn close to a worst case scenario flop for you. So I think there are a lot of flops where if you're right that this guy has kings or queens or jacks, you're going to get a stack, and this is not necessarily one of those flops. So the first thing you need to be thinking now, considering the range you've put him on, is how can I get how can I get him to put the rest of his money or at least some more money in there sometimes with a hand other than ace king? I think if he has ace king, you're gonna stack him here, but there's only so many combinations of that left. How can we get a stack if he has kings or queens or jacks, or if he has maybe something that you're not thinking, maybe he has king queen suited and you're just a little bit off about his range. How can we get him to put the rest of his money into the pot? I don't think that should begin with continuation betting. He says he considered making a 40 to 50% pot bet to look like a standard continuation bet. I don't know that the word standard really belongs in a conversation that starts with a cold four bet.
It's to a 30-year stack.
I think that it's not really, this isn't just like a normal, I'm just betting because I missed the flop. I mean, this guy can probably put the hero on a pretty tight range of hands for cold four betting, so it's not like he necessarily expects you to just be firing in the flop with anything. I mean, you're not really going to have anything here. You really should be thinking of representing a specific hand because there's only so many that you would have four bet with in the first place. And I think that you can, maybe, and here later suggested he should have done this, checked to show concern for the ace. So yeah, I think you want to make as if you had just four bet with kings or queens, and now you get an ace high flop, and you're pretty worried about that. Hopefully, what's going to happen there is that either if your opponent has kings, maybe he starts to think, hey, my kings could be good here. If he doesn't like that ace, then my kings are probably good. Or maybe your opponent has jacks, or he has king queen suited, and he's thinking, hey, maybe I can get this guy to fold if he has kings or queens because he's worried about the ace.
And I think if you do that, the story to tell on the turn, if it goes blank and then he checks to you again, is to bet something small.
Yeah, the turn is the time for that small bet, not the flop.
And I think I actually do see people do that with big pocket pairs where, so before the flop goes raise, three bet, four bet, fold, call. And the flop comes, and then the flop goes check, check. And then if the turn goes check, then some really tiny bet, a lot of times it's just somebody feeling obligated to bet and just totally lost in the hand. And it's like, well, I have kings, I'll just throw some money out there.
Yeah, even 40% I think would be too big. I think like 20 to 30% pot is probably what I would look to bet on the turn, and then I would just shove the river. But probably that river bet's not going to get paid off if it goes just check call small bet on the turn. But I think that's about the best you can do.
Probably. And I do think, I think I've seen this before. I do think you might induce a raise with that on the turn because, I think that's the best way to look like somebody who's gotten completely lost in the hand with queens or something like that. So.
I think the fundamental problem here is the same as it was pre-flop, which is that although the hero is putting his opponent on a range, he's not really thinking about, well, A, he's not thinking too much about what he himself is representing, and B, he's not thinking about how to get, what would be the best way to get that range to put more money into the pot. So he's kind of has an idea of what the range looks like, but he hasn't really set a target, and he doesn't have a clear plan for, what story am I going to tell to convince my opponent to put more money into the pot with these hands that I think he's likely to have. And I
I think
think
that's
doing
right.
that gets more, I mean, it means shoving the pre-flop, and if for somehow you don't do that, then it means checking the flop.
And I think this gets back to a different kind of skill. I think I got better at these kinds of spots when I stopped waiting until it was my turn to act to look at my cards. This is something we've talked about on the show before, but I know that I have a lot easier time when I know I have aces and then I see the button raise and I think, okay, what happens if the small blind three bet? It's more time, especially like if you roll back the clock 4 years to when I had a lot less tournament experience. That's easier for me to handle. But then when it goes, you're watching, button raise, small blind, three bet, it's like, okay, interesting. He's tight. He's probably got a good hand. Wham, aces. I think that can be a lot harder for people. So, I think this is practical. If you're an amateur player, especially if you're worried about everybody staring you down as you're looking at your cards, I think if it's a situation where you're a little bit not intimidated, but it's the main event, it's exciting. If you want to give yourself those extra brain cycles, or even if you don't, I think looking at your cards anytime earlier when you think that other people aren't looking at you, I think that can be a really good thing to do.
Well, thank you for the hand, Sticky Stuffed. Hopefully we've been helpful and not too cruel to you.
No, hopefully not. And another excellent decision Mr. Soft made here is to email the podcast. That's a good way to get better at poker. You send in hands, we talk about them, and sometimes we berate you, but most of the time we approach the situation with kindness. So. We got Tommy on the show this week, and we are going to ask him a bunch of listener questions, and we are also going to talk about one of the listener questions now as part of our mailbag segment.
Yeah, this one, I think, it's a question that's inspired by a line from Tommy's book, but I don't think that Tommy's book actually provides a lot of insight into this particular problem. So it's a question regarding Section 31 of Elements of Poker, which is called Firstlessness. And Tommy says, from the small blind, I'm charged a fee for something I wouldn't want for free. Our correspondent says, I take this to mean that Tommy needs a very good reason to play the small blind, and he likely folds it a lot. I've heard Mark from Tournament Poker Edge say that he always raises King X from the small blind because it's the second best card in poker. Mike Leah says to raise if you're going to play it because he doesn't want to let the big blind see a flop for free. Dan Negreanu says to limp in because you don't want to blow up the pot out of position. I have no idea what is right, and I end up folding it a lot. I always thought this was a leak. Is Tommy suggesting that it is not a leak?
I think, have we talked about this on the show before? Boy, you can tell we've been at this for a while.
I think we talked about yeah, open limping every hand from the small blind, inspired by that.
Man, that was a good strategy talk. I like that one. I'm getting nostalgic now. What can I say?
Yeah, let's actually. What we should figure out what episode that was and reference it here. It was one of the pretty. It was a pretty early one.
Yeah, but not that early. I'm gonna guess it was like episode 12.
I think it was 12
or 13, maybe. I think we spread it out over two.
That's true.
Over two episodes, because we had a lot to say.
Yeah, you were good. I think episode 13 was one of the.
Heyo! I won the prop bet 2 weeks ago, and now
that's right.
Shop yeah. It.
So. Apparently, Olivier Bousquet does pronounce his name Bousquet, so I lost a dollar on that. So yeah, one suggestion here. Nate nailed it. Go back to podcast episode 13 featuring Russ Fox, and you can hear an extended discussion on open limping from the small blind. And so that I think was a pretty high level conversation about how to play the small blind. So maybe now we can talk a little more broadly about this, the central problem of like, or maybe even about the idea from the book, like I'm getting charged a fee for something I would want for free. Does that mean that you should be folding the small blind a lot?
Actually, I was going to take a different road in. I think Tommy's warning is right, which is that if you have a junk hand, then just the fact that you're getting a 50% discount doesn't mean that that automatically makes it worth it. I mean, you're going to have to play out of position. A lot of times there are going to be reverse implied odds issues. And, the extra $2 that you save because you've already put in the $2 in a 2-5 game, there are a lot of hands for which that won't tip the scales from a fold into a call.
I think I will call out of the big blind because I'm getting a better price with hands that I wouldn't call from other positions. I really don't do that in the small blind. Like I don't think that $2 in the pot ever really motivates my decision except in limped pots. Like if there's a raise, I don't really think about the $2 I already have in the pot.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right for me. Although it pretty frequently limp pots happen. So if four people limp, then I'm in the small blind with ace deuce offsuit. I will put in the $3, but I might not put in $5. I mean, I certainly
yeah, that's
put
a fair $5.
Point. So good, good. And I'll repeat now something that I think I remember myself saying a variant of, all those months ago, which is that when you're opening the action in the small blind, so it folds around to you, you've got whatever you've got, and Mike Leah says this, and Daniel Negreanu says this, and somebody else says that. I think this is one of the most opponent-dependent spots in poker. This is not like aces in the big blind facing a cold 3-bet, where I think it's going to be hard to construct a situation where you shouldn't be jamming preflop, or a lot of what we said I think applies to a wide variety of opponents, and certainly to almost all opponents that could be described as pretty tight. Here, there are going to be a lot of people against whom it's profitable just to raise before the flop and bet the flop. And that's just how it is. And so, there's a high burden of proof to convince yourself that limping and then playing a flop is going to be better than that. That said, I really do like, especially in a tournament where the rake doesn't matter as much, I do like to limp in and keep the pot small. I think that's really good. I like to play the flop.
I do that all the time in live poker.
Yeah.
I mean, online, so people will raise you pretty automatically when you try to open limp from the small blind. But I mean, if you're in the right, like kind of loose passive live game, I mean, I will never open fold my small blind. And like, there's plenty of hands that I won't consider good enough to raise, but I'm just going to open limp with them because people, they're only going to raise 15% of hands or something.
Yeah. And, you know, it's good. I mean, you might get raked to death. Make sure you're not going to get raked to death first. But in which
Yeah,
case,
sorry,
try to
I
stop
meant
it.
in a tournament.
Yeah, but, you know, in a tournament, it's just so good
Those
to get a...
people who never raise their big blind are also people who are very eager to chop.
Yes. And, you know, everything you said, you just really want to play those pots. You learn so much. I mean, especially the person to your left, that person matters so much in a tournament. You want to know everything about that person, everything. Especially given that there are so many other reasons to limp the small blind, just having a strategy that involves a lot of limping, you have to play so many pots. You can just learn so much about that person, you know, whose dispositions are so important to your overall well-being in the tournament. It's just great. That's a big reason why I think folding would be really bad. And I don't usually advocate doing things to gain information, but I do think that this already good play of completing the small blind gets even better when you think about how much you learn about the guy to your left.
Yeah. And it's worth pointing out that this is not, I don't think this is even the situation that Tommy is has in mind when he's making this statement. I really think he's talking more about calling raises out of the small blind than he is playing when it folds around to you in the small blind. Because a lot of people do tend to think of that. I think especially I'm not a, much of a limit player, but I think especially in limit poker, people tend to think like, oh, I'm getting a discount, so I'll play out of the small blind. I kind of took Tommy's comment specifically to be a response to that. That common belief that you're getting a discount.
I do think so, but I also think that Tommy believes that even if it's limped around, I think Tommy folds his small blind a lot, even in multi-way limped pots. I can remember some article that he wrote where, you know, it's all very artful. I'm not going to do it justice, but like there are six limpers and he folds the small blind and he says, even with all those limpers, especially with all those limpers. And the idea is that he thinks that having to beat all those people out of position is actually overwhelms the effect of getting the better pot odds. As it happens, I probably disagree with him about that, but I do think just as a matter of Tommy exegesis, I think it applies even in limp pots pretty often, at limit and no limit.
Okay. You're right that you really don't want to be following anybody's generic advice. I mean, you just can't really give generic advice about how to play a spot like this.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it depends on things that are so specific. I mean, there's sort of the basic stuff like, you know, is my hand the sort of thing that I can hit a lot of flops with? That's basic stuff. And then there's other stuff like, do I want to play a big pot with this hand? But then, you know, there's so much stuff about your opponent that, first off, a lot of people play differently in blind battles than they do elsewhere. And also, like with certain kinds of hands. So, one hand that has come up in the question is King X, where somebody says, raise because you have the second best card in poker, which is a strange way to put it. I'm not sure I see what's going on there, but maybe I should just go watch the video or something. But I mean, but like whether I would do that would depend on things like how hard does that person barrel with one pair on the turn? You know, it's like a lot of that would actually have to do with this person's turn betting frequency with exactly one pair, both top pair and not top pair. Like those factors would be very important in deciding whether I would limp or raise with King three offsuit. And so when things like that are mattering so much, then you really just can't give one size fits all advice.
So what should someone do if they feel, as I imagine many of our listeners do, woefully incapable of answering a question like that? There's like, I have no idea how often my opponent barrels the turn with top pair or with one pair.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question. I think what I like to do is to revert to very general principles. So for me, one reason I like to limp so much is that first, I'm usually getting decent odds. If it's a tournament, there are often antes in the pot, so I'm getting a nice price. And I want to keep the pot small out of position. And, you know, I'm probably going to be limping a fair number of hands. And in the absence of other information, I think that, you know, sort of deriving your answer from general principles of poker, which is like when the decision is close, you should want to play smaller pots out of position. When the decision is close, you should,
Pay attention to pot odds.
I guess, paying attention to pot odds is better. So I think that's good. On the other hand, you have some of these basic poker reasons on the other side, which is when your hand suffers from possible reverse implied odds, choose the thing that will be most likely to win you the pot immediately. So, but I guess that's right. You know, if I thought that a raise would win me the pot immediately, then maybe I would just raise King three, you know, very often. So I guess my general advice is to think about general principles of poker. Barring that, I do love keeping the pot small out of position. So,
yeah, I think, I mean, use these as opportunities, not just to learn about the player on your left, although I do think that's good advice, but also just opportunities to learn about poker in general. I mean, one of the reasons why it's so hard to give generic advice here is A, because it's so player specific, and B, because both players' ranges are going to be so wide after the flop, no matter what you do. Whether you, if you limp, obviously your range is extremely wide, but even when you raise, like, your range, your opponent is going to expect you to be raising quite a lot of hands from there. He's probably going to call or even re-raise you with quite a lot of hands. I think this is what you're hinting at when you said people play differently in blind battles. There's a lot of times you'll see people who are otherwise tight players, they will correctly call a lot of hands out of the big blind in the spot, or three bets in hands they wouldn't ordinarily three bet. I just think this is a spot where people recognize, like, ranges are really wide here, and I can't just, you know, I can't just play top 10% of hands and try to make top pair the way I do in any other situation. I think even pretty nitty players get that a little bit more in the blinds. So this is an opportunity for you to really exercise your poker muscle a little bit, meaning that you're going to have to think through some uncommon scenarios. I mean, as you can probably tell from our babbling right now, you could probably write a 300-page book on how to handle a situation like this and try to account for all the different player types and stack sizes and all this sort of stuff and still not really thoroughly cover the subject. Like, this just isn't a case where you're going to get a formula. You're going to have to play poker here. And I think it's a good opportunity to do that because it prepares you for many other situations where you're also dealing with a wide range versus a wide range. For instance, you know, you open the button, the big blind calls, or the button opens and you call out of your big blind. I mean, these are also spots where two people have extremely wide ranges and you are really forced to play poker. You can't just revert to a, you know, try to flop top pair, top kicker or better and then go from there. You have to be bluffing and bluff raising and inducing bluffs and, you know, just try to puzzle through the situation yourself and maybe send us a more specific hand example.
I think that's right. And I also think that it's good practice for getting called when you raise. I mean, the modern poker player, especially the modern tournament player who can be a little bit tighter, is looking for spots to put you out of position, you know, to be first, and will try to engineer situations so that you're playing the most pots when you're out of position. And so, you know, getting that practice out of position when you're in the small blind is very useful, I think.
So
can I tell a story?
Yeah, please.
It's an unrelated story. It's when you said you could write a 300-page book about this. It brought back, like, the super fond memory from my childhood when I was really into bridge. It was elementary school, and I had read all the books about bridge twice from my local library.
I love the story already, by the way. Just as an elementary school student, you're really into bridge and have read every book that you can find on bridge.
I mean, it's not that impressive. Like, I'm not like some people.
I don't think it's impressive. I think it's telling of character. Go on.
Yeah, no, and I wasn't like a super prodigy. I have no master points or anything, and I was never like, my mind is not really well suited to bridge, actually. But anyway, I was really into it. I was really, really into it. I would, like, make up my own bidding systems and things like that. And so my dear loving mother drove me across town to another public library where there would be more books that I could read about bridge, right? And, like, I get to the bridge section or, like, the games section. And there's a shelf of bridge books. And, like, first off, there are, like, 7 books about bridge. And this is, like, so exciting to me. And this is before the internet, right? Or before I had any idea about the internet. And, like, this much information about one subject in one place was thrilling to me, right? And then I saw this thick book, like 1.5 or 2 inches thick. And it was called The Opening Lead in Bridge. And my jaw just dropped. I mean, somebody had written so much, not just about the game of bridge, but about just how to choose the opening lead when you're on defense. And this was really exciting to me. And I don't remember how much of the book I read. I don't know how much of it I understood. I don't remember what happens next. I remember just, it was this amazing realization. Similar to, you know, stepping in some kind of physics class and like, oh, well, let's think about this simple thing. And then you learn that it's incredibly complicated and that it would take 25 years to learn this one subject, you know. It's like, oh, man, somebody wrote 300 pages about the opening lead at bridge. And I've been playing games ever since. I still suck at bridge, but whatever. Anyway, and you could write even a bigger book about playing King X out, or playing out of the small blind in this situation. You'd probably write a comparable book just while playing King X in this situation.
But yeah, I mean, bottom line is play poker, have fun, experiment, try to think it through, and send us an example. Club book for the month of May is going to be Jared Tendler's Mental Game of Poker 2. It just went on sale last week, and if you don't have a copy already, if you're going to pick up a copy from Amazon, go there via thinkingpoker.net, use our Amazon affiliate link when you buy the book. It's not going to cost you anything extra, but it'll kick a few dollars back to the show, and Nate and I will appreciate it. In fact, this works for anything you buy from Amazon, so the next time you're shopping, using our affiliate link is a great way to help us out while you do it. There are 5 Wednesdays in May, and we're going to do things a little bit differently this month. Instead of a formal book club save it next week, our first discussion of Mental Game of Poker 2 is going to be on episode 31. That's the episode that comes out on May 8th. And at that time, we'll be discussing the first 2 chapters of the book. That's the introduction and the chapter called The Zone, pages 1 through 55. So you'll want to get yourself a copy of Mental Game of Poker 2. Remember to use that affiliate link when you buy it, and read the first 55 pages before you listen to episode 31, coming out on May 8th.
Morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
How are you today, Sammy?
Good.
Yeah. Is it normal for you to be up this early?
Yeah, I get up at about 4:30.
Oh, wow.
Something like that, and meditate for a while, and that's how I start.
So you're not really keeping poker players' hours anymore?
Well, I used to actually go play at 4 in the morning.
I guess that's a great time to play.
No, but actually, it does seem like I'm, whatever career I'm in, I'm very often up at like 2, 3, 4, either from being up all night or from getting up early.
The yeah, the early mornings do seem like more writer's hours. I think a number of writers have said that's when they get the most work done.
Yeah, it's great. I really like it. Right now, my wife she's out of town right now, but she gets up pretty early to go to work. And so for me to get up an hour and a half before her, I got to get up pretty darn early. But it all works out.
But she expects to have that coffee ready when she gets up.
Oh, and breakfast, the whole deal.
I'm curious if there are any like common misunderstandings of the book that you've encountered, and if you have any general advice about how to read the book or how to approach it.
Oh yeah, there have been some misunderstandings. I won't be able to just call them up, but some of the misunderstandings are also kind of intentional. So there are some places in the book where I felt like I was explaining a concept, and other places I felt I was just throwing down an idea to like begin the discussion in the reader's mind. And in those cases, I didn't mind being a little more, you know, confusing and cryptic.
Right.
So yeah, there's some confusion that was unintentional, some that wasn't.
Do you have any examples off the top of your head of the places where you were trying to be a little more cryptic or just start a conversation?
Well, some of the stuff. Okay, I do have an example of that. In the table poker section about hands on face, where it just says, you know, if you notice that your hands are on your face, either lower your hands or raise your face or both,
right.
Or something like that, right? And so that particular element is a pretty good example of what happened with quite a few of them, which is, I had collected a fair amount of material under that heading. and wrote it up, you know, and was writing it up. And then for whatever reason, it was too wordy or this or that, you know, things just get melted down in the revising process. And that's a good example of one where I thought, you know, just by giving it its own element, even though it's only two lines, I was trying to impress upon the reader, okay, I think this is really important. You know, I'm not writing a whole lot about it, but it's really important. Mm-hmm. Another one is there's a place within one of the elements where I say, dwell on this word, impermanence. Okay, so the word impermanence is one of those words within, you know, the Buddhistic teaching. The first few times it showed up, I was just like, wow, what a great word. You know, what a great concept. Even without the teachings, it's just like the word itself really opened my mind. And then, of course, I read a bunch about it, and I was going to write all this stuff about it for the book, and I just ended up throwing it all out. It was like, you know, I just thought, I'll just get introduced the reader to this word, and maybe that'll have some of the same effect it had on me, where the word itself was kind of enough to get you going.
Like the process of thinking about it is more valuable than just being told this is what it means.
And it's just an introduction. Right. Yeah, exactly. But anytime I explained it, it was either in the way I was explaining it or just the wordiness of it. It was like it was detracting from the initial impact of just the word itself if you are new to it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like what you said about, or it caught my attention, what you said about, even though it was an important concept, you didn't say very much about it, but just giving it its own segment signaled that it was important. Because that's one thing that strikes me as a potential source of confusion, is that the most important concepts in the book, I feel like, don't necessarily get the most, page space, or, you know, they don't necessarily get the most words devoted to them. And so sometimes you can look through and say, like, oh, he spends all this time talking about one thing and not a lot of time talking about something else. And does that mean that the one thing is more important than the other, which maybe isn't the case. But I mean, there was one passage in particular that kind of jumped out to me, especially on my first reading of, it's just a couple of paragraphs that you spend talking about how to move your chips. You know, if you're going to change seats and you can stack your chips in a certain way and learning how to push them across the table so that they don't spill over. And it's not like an uninteresting or useless concept, but it has several paragraphs devoted to it, whereas certain other things that seem like they're probably in some sense more important to you get only one or two sentences. And I have a bit of a theory about that now, but I'm curious if you want to say anything about either that or about in general, like why you chose to talk at more at length about certain concepts than others.
Well, okay, but you know, I like to go last. So, what's your theory?
So it seemed to me, I think on my first time reading it through, I just didn't get it. Yeah. The second time through, if I had to guess, I guess my second time through, I was kind of reading the book as more like a practical guide towards how to achieve these idealistic extremes, or maybe how to work towards them, because I guess the idea is you don't really achieve them ever. So the idea was like trying to give very specific things that will cause you to actually get closer towards doing these things. In some cases, even things that you might already acknowledge are important, but you don't ever actually work towards doing them. So, you know, most players will acknowledge, if you ask them, where should I be sitting at the table, you know, or you know, should they'll have a theory on what is the best seat at the table, but they won't necessarily be real aggressive about seeking it out. Or, I mean, I myself am kind of reluctant to change seats, mostly, I guess, just out of inertia, or like, well, I'm already here, I'm comfortable, I'm not going to change my seat. So it seems like just the hassle of moving your chips might be one deterrent for people to changing seats at all. So that the advice is not really just about how to move your chips, given that you're going to change your seat, but it's really about how to feel comfortable changing seats generally.
Uh-huh.
That was my
Yeah, that's totally wrong. No, that's interesting. So here's what, there's two topics here. One is the idea of seat changes of, you know, and the it's kind of fun to talk about this book, you know, 6 years later, because I've done so much coaching on these topics now. I really do have a solid feel for which things matter, mm-hmm. way more so than I did when I was even writing the book. So there's really two things under seat changes here. One is the idea that's in the book about, you know, if you get tight players on your left, you've done like 90% of the work. You know, the diminishing returns kick in after that kind of thing, right? That and that concept has been very helpful to a lot of people, and I've gotten a lot of feedback where they said, wow, that's just such a really simple way of looking at it. I hadn't thought about that. It works great, and blah, blah, blah. Okay. So that's in one part of the book. And then the part about the actual physical moving of the chips, that is under the part about, it might be under how to play No Limit with Ruthless Efficiency or something like that. But in the table poker section, there's a, at the, in the intro, there's a place where I say that, you know, none of these things are that big a deal on their own, but when combined, they build up an image of, you know, a professional impenetrable image. Okay. Well, now that I've gone through this table poker coaching thing, you know, with a whole bunch of clients since the book came out, I can report that I have seen the transformation many times right before my eyes in the course of a week, because we do a 3-day program in Vegas. It's like 3.5 days now. And we end up playing together 4 times, 4 nights in a row. We play together in the same game for about 2 or 3 hours. And then each day, then, you know, among the other topics we go over this table poker stuff, how to handle your chips, how to sit, what to say, not say, and all this stuff, starting with what I've seen with that particular client. And then we make some changes. And I've watched guys go from feeling intimidated, looking intimidated, feeling worried, you know, to being so confident after 3 or 4 days. I'm like, I would stake this guy, you know. And it is partly from the strategy stuff we talk about and partly from the mindset stuff we talk about, but most of it is nothing more than just physical behavior, just the physical behavior itself. And I tell them, I say, if you do these things, even if it doesn't feel like you're a rock solid mountain right now, it will look like you are, and they will act like you are, and they will respond to you in that way. And it creates this feedback loop that you've never experienced before, where you're going to be getting a type of respect, and it's strictly from behavior. And so, you know, until I had actually come out with the book, put that stuff in there, and then gone over it multiple times with clients, I would never have believed so strongly that the advice in there will work at doing what it claims to do, which is create this image. None of the particular things matter that much. But if you know how to slide your chips around and you know how to do all these different things, it all combines.
So can you say a little bit more about what exactly you mean when you say respect?
Oh, by respect, I mean when the hand is over, the way people will comment about you or not comment about you, about what you did or what you or anything like that. It isn't respect for strictly about your betting strategy.
So it's not just like, oh, they respect me as a good player.
Right. They respect you as a good player. Well, okay, let's say you've got a guy in your game that you know is a good player. You know, you've met him before. You've seen him before. Mm-hmm. Okay. And everyone knows, you know, he really, really understands betting strategy. Okay. But the guy behaves like a dick, or he makes petty comments, or he's mean to the waitress or whatever. Okay. So you can respect his poker skills, but not respect him. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so what the combination of, you know, the good betting, good behavior creates a level of respect that's deeper than just poker skill. And it also creates a word that's just as important as respect here is fear. It creates fear, because when you are anticipating every move, and you're doing everything like it's scripted, you know, during the hands and after the hands, and buying in and adding on, and everything is done not in a machine-like way, but just in a natural, relaxed, unemotional, comfortable way, you know, hour after hour. And whenever there's talk on Sixth Street about the hand, you know, if everyone at the table is generally interacting at a level of discourse where, you know, there are certain judgments that are made and certain presumptions about judgments are made and all that. And if you have a player who literally resides above that, you know, the whole time for hours, it commands respect, but it also generates fear, because people don't know what you're thinking. They don't know what you're thinking about, but what they, one thing they know is that it doesn't seem like anything they do is going to matter to you, you know, whether they beat you, whether they talk to you. And so it all combines to create a type of fear and respect that is highly exploitable. It's enjoyable, and it can't be achieved by betting skill alone.
Yeah, you know, I think I've had that exact experience of, like, especially at the World Series of Poker, maybe when you get moved to a new table and you're kind of trying to size up the table and you're like, oh, there's this one player at the table, he's on my left and he seems like he's playing really well. And, you know, I can get a little intimidated by that person. They're just thinking like, you know, this guy is going to be a problem for me. And then, you know, maybe an hour into it or something, I'll see him berate another player for how he's playing or get frustrated about something. And he does suddenly become much less, and I'm just like, oh, he's kind of a tilt monkey too, or, you know, just he becomes less fearsome.
Right, he's just like us.
Yeah,
exactly. And it only takes one little puncture like that to burst the bubble of that could take hours to build up.
Yeah, you see the man behind the curtain.
Yes.
Well, the first of our listener questions that we have comes from someone named Steve. And he said that it seems like that you've had many issues with tilt over time. Do you now consider yourself tilt-free, or do you still have occasional flare-ups?
No, I'm not tilt-free, but I'm defining tilt here like it is in Elements of Poker, where anything but pure A game mm-hmm. is tilt. So, no, I don't have emotional flare-ups, let's say, anything close to like I've had before. Mm. And my self-correcting mechanisms, when I do, you know, slip down into, say, a little bit, a level of despondency or, you know, some negative mindset, the triggers that I've built up, you know, kick in pretty fast. And there's always some combination of breathing or taking a break or, you know, texting my wife or something. You know, I've got so many ways to pull myself right back up to my A game as soon as I start to dip down. And then the other thing that I think is one of the reasons I don't dip very much or very deeply is that I prepare like crazy. I mean, I basically never play unless I'm perfectly rested, perfectly fed, you know, everything is lined up great. Mm-hmm. So it's a combination of those things and years. But yeah, I just don't have any kind of major tilt episodes at all.
And Steve also had a follow-up to that, which is that, do you find it more frustrating when you do tilt now because you feel like you should be beyond that or that you ought to be able to avoid it? Does it feel more like a failure when you do find yourself tilting at all?
No, not at all. You know, I cut myself a lot of slack on all this stuff. I mean, you know, there's lots of little ways to tilt, you know, at the table or not. And I think a big part of a successful plan or path toward, you know, reducing tilt is cutting yourself slack at every point. And that's a big, big part of it. You know, so if you do tilt or if I do something that's, you know, beneath the bar I've set for myself, my reaction more now is more likely just to laugh at myself than beat myself up. That in itself is part of a healthy path, you know, because there's always going to be leaks. There's always going to be stuff like that. So no, I don't get frustrated. You know, every once in a while I'll play a hand, you know, make some crazy play or whatever, and then follow it up with a bad play. And it's like only in that moment was I able to play it that badly. And then I just kind of laugh at it. You know, it's a whole different, much lighter approach to, you know, quote unquote mistakes and errors. And just like recognize that, you know, I like the phrase, you know, have failure built into the system. There's no way to make the best possible play we can make all the time. No way to be tiltless all the time. I mean, relative to whatever we're used to. And that's just the way it is. So accepting that is, I think, a key part of it all.
Yeah, I've kind of thought of that. I mean, in the same way that you expect that bad beats are going to happen. I mean, I don't think any serious poker player sits down thinking that he's going to win every time he has the best hand. I mean, I feel like it might be reasonable to sit down and expect that a certain number of mistakes are going to happen. So rather than thinking like, well, the bad beats are beyond my control, but the mistakes are within my control, you know, you might say that some amount of mistake is also built in, or it's not really entirely within your control to never make a mistake.
Exactly. I agree.
Another question from Steve was, do you find it difficult to watch people who you know and people who you like struggle with? So he said, I'm wondering about the balance between being cold-blooded and being not attached. Cold-blooded being my own way of perhaps describing the wrong version of not attached. Like, I guess, how do you show concern for things that other people are worrying about if they're things that you think are not worth worrying about?
That is a really good question. I'm going to tangent a little bit. The book I'm working on right now, Painless Poker, a lot of the grist for the mill for this book, which is turning into be mostly fiction, is from questions just like this that I've gotten in, from clients and interviews and random emails. And this particular question is a biggie. It really is. And it's been asked many times, not just of me, but of, it's just been asked many times. This whole thing about where do you draw the line between, if attachment is what causes our pain and detachment is good, then what do I do when I'm witnessing pain? How do you handle dealing with all the suffering in the world is another way of putting it, right? But back to your specific case, how do you be? No, the question was more like about somebody you know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he was thinking that might be a harder thing to.
Right. Okay. So it's kind of like there's a time and place for each thing. Okay. So at the table, if you see your buddy struggling and tilting and all this, and what you want to do is help him not tilt, okay, at that moment, it really depends a lot on how well he's going to receive your words at that time, whether you should speak or not. So I'll give you a couple examples. If it's a friend of yours and you've had conversations about this, I'll go in one extreme would be, and he said, the next time you see me languishing over there and wallowing in my, all the noise in my head, text me and tell me to snap out of it or say something or do something. So here you've been given license to help, okay? Which is kind of how it is when with my clients. I'm the door's open for me to give any suggestions I can think of. On the other hand, if your buddy is like a if his tilt problem is similar to say a an alcoholic who doesn't think he has a drinking problem, and he's over there tilting away and you want to help and you go, man, hey buddy, you're on tilt, you need to stop. Well, and he's got the needle in his arm, that's the last thing he wants to hear. So all you're doing is throwing gas on the fire when you say that. So it really depends. It really depends. You got to look, understand the situation and mindfully think about, okay, what really is the best thing I can do for my friend right now? So that's some ideas in terms of what to do. In terms of how to not be unhappy over his unhappiness, that goes straight to the heart of the cause of unhappiness in the first place. So you could you, one way to analyze it would be, okay, I'm unhappy because my friend's unhappy. Why am I unhappy because my friend's unhappy? Well, because I'm attached to his happiness. I need him to be happy for me to be happy. When he's miserable, it brings me down. And so, we're basically our happiness is like intertwined in that way. And so the best thing you can do at any given moment for your friend and his unhappiness is to adjust your own happiness. Is to try to bring yourself up to a positive, congenial, optimistic state, despite the fact that he's suffering. And if you can do that, that will always put you in the best position to say and think the things that will help him the best. And then you can up the happiness of the whole system, his and yours.
So, when you have a buddy who will feel pain if you say something to him, but really ought to leave the game, and you can tell it's kind of wavering, you just lost a pot or something, and he needs to leave, and he sort of knows that he needs to leave, but he isn't quite sure yet, and he's wavering. Do you have a way of saying, like, I know in my old college home game, it was, hey, John, do you need a walk? Maybe you should go take a walk. I mean, do you have a favorite way of gently suggesting to somebody whose well-being you care about in some way that this is not the right night for them to be playing poker anymore?
Well, I mean it gently is the key word. As you say that, I'm trying to picture various scenarios in my head. Every one of them is different. One way to do it is just to quit. I mean, literally just get up and go. you know, Matt Flynn, who's written some poker books, you know, we used to play together in San Francisco, and he coined this term drafting. He would, like, it'd be 1 a.m, and, you know, he's supposed to go, and I would see, you know, he's supposed to go, and I would leave, I would quit, and then he would draft, he'd like a bicycle, and he would draft behind me on the way to the cage. We joked about this all the time. So I can't think of any specific things, but if you are really determined to give it your best shot, you know, you got to say something, do something, whatever, you know, stand away from the table and say, hey, come here, you know, and he'll know why you're saying come here. And if he refuses to get up, then you just have to let him sink, yeah. You know,
right.
at some point you can't sacrifice your happiness just because he's going to blow an extra 500, you know, the time to work on that is the next day or the next day if he's willing to, you know, talk about it. But I didn't really answer your question. I mean, there's no specific way to gently do that. It's a delicate situation.
This is from TJ, who says, first of all, I just want to tell Tommy that I think the book is brilliant. Just reading it 2 times through has allowed me to carry over so many lessons, not just at the table, but also in life. One specific section that I'm still wrestling with is the section called Focus. Everything seemed to make perfect sense until I came across this statement, quote, cautionary note, thinking about thinking still counts as thinking. Can you explain the difference between thinking about thinking and focusing on mind training? They seem to be the same to me.
That's a decent example of one of the things I put in there that didn't want to, you know, I intentionally didn't explain. So I'm actually reading the passage. I didn't understand how concentration exercises worked until right after I started doing them. One thing that happens when you start doing mind reps is you come to realize that your thoughts are whizzing by out of your control virtually every waking moment of your life. What you do during focusing training is sublimely simple. You stop the thinking. That's it. Cautionary note, thinking about thinking still counts as thinking. Okay, so this is really about the act of meditation and what you do with your mind. And, you know, in this context, the phrase focusing training is equivalent to meditation. So meditation does many things and it takes many forms, but it among the things it does is it is training to help focus. And the way that happens is by losing focus and coming back to focus, losing focus, coming back to focus over and over and over, you know, just like doing reps on a weightlifting. Now, losing focus is very easy. That's the most natural thing that'll happen. So that it doesn't take any effort to do that at all. All of the effort is about returning to focus. Now, the idea of stopping the thinking is the basic tool that will reduce or eliminate unhappiness in any given moment, because the unhappiness is generated by thoughts about the past or the future or some dissatisfaction, you know, something about reality that you wish was different. Okay, so if you were to stop the thinking in any way, whether it was with drugs or, you know, hitting yourself with a hammer or dying, any of those would stop the unhappiness, okay? So with the meditation, when you focus on breathing or something else that's going on in the moment and you're focused on it completely, then whatever thoughts that were going on have stopped temporarily, and so the unhappiness is gone. This line about thinking still counts as thinking means if you're doing the focusing and you're focusing on your breathing and the thought comes up to you and the thought says, hey, I'm doing it right now. I'm stopping my thinking. I'm doing it. It's like you're, you know, like you're on a bicycle and you take the training wheels off and you're coasting all of a sudden. You're like, wow, you know, I'm doing it. Okay. Well, that's a great thought. It really means that you're thinking about the really good stuff, but it's still thinking, you know, thinking about the thinking is no different than thinking about a hand. And I put this in as a cautionary note, because when you read books about meditation, they put it in there. You know, a lot of this stuff I just took right out of the books I read and put it in my book. But this is a fairly common thing where the mind plays all these little tricks on itself, because you can sit there and thinking, okay, I'm thinking about not thinking, you know, so am I am I meditating or am I still thinking or whatever? And the answer to all that is yes, no, whatever. You just got to dive in there and do it. And you keep, you know, you raise up levels. You know, you're at one level where you're thinking, but you don't realize you're thinking. And then the next level, because you're doing the breathing, you're aware. Oh, I was just thinking about this hand I lost, or I was just thinking about the fact that I'm sitting here thinking about thinking. All of that, it's all just part of the soup that goes on as you go through this training of focusing on the breathing, and then the thoughts come up, and then you label the thoughts thinking, go back to the breathing, back and forth.
I'm curious, given the analogy to like weight training or repetitions, I mean, that's the kind of thing that you definitely wouldn't try to do all day, every day. When you're practicing weight training, you would like, you know, practice it, do some reps at a specific time, and then give yourself time to recover. Do you have any thought on whether it makes sense to do the same thing with mental training, to only try to do it at certain times? Or do you think like at every opportunity you should be trying to?
Well, you know, you just expanded the weight training analogy into an area I hadn't thought of before, which is you do both. Even as a physical trainer, if you're in training to get your body in the best possible shape, you have the periods of intense workout, like at the gym, okay? And that would be the equivalent to the actual sitting meditation, where you're like, okay, I'm just going to carve out this time. I'm going to sit here and I'm not going to move. I'm going to do the work. However, you also might have in your car little hand grips that you can grip to strengthen your forearms. Or you might, come to an office building and you got to go meet a guy on the fifth floor and you decide to take the stairs as part of your physical training. Mm. So your consciousness is aware of your physical training all day long. And like if you're an athlete in training, you're looking for opportunities to get a little bit of extra workout in, even if it's small. And I would say that it's exactly the same way with the mindfulness stuff and the focusing training, where you got your major workout, and that actually gives you a lot of strength and a lot of momentum to then do small workouts all through the day.
And it really is a sort of extended practice, right? Like if you're really serious, I mean, just to take the metaphor a little bit further, if you're serious enough, you're eating in a certain way, you're walking in a certain way, you're stretching in a certain way, such that your workout regimen really does sort of expand over your whole life.
And, yeah. Yes, that's right. It is. It's a solid analogy even to that level.
Next question comes from Mike, who says, Mr. Angelo says that some decisions are so complex that the right answer is unknowable and that we shouldn't worry about whether we come up with the right answer in close decisions. Maybe this is just semantics, but I believe that every answer at the table is knowable. Of course, this is not necessarily practical at the table, given the time constraints of poker. But if we put enough time and effort into the thought process, maybe later away from the table, we can find a solution that is the most correct answer. And it is also the search for the most correct answer that leads us to a stronger decision-making process and better future discussions. Better future decisions. I guess that's more of a disagreement than a question, but any thoughts on that?
Well, I heard a little bit of a contradiction there, and that I agree that you can always try to get the best answer given the information that you have. But it sounded like in the first part of his question, he believed that there would always be an answer that you know to be the right answer. And that I would disagree with, you know. So we can determine what the variables are and weight them correctly and plug in whatever information we happen to have and produce the best answer we can produce. Mm-hmm. But as we know, the information isn't always complete. And so we can't always know that the answer that we're going to be able to come up with the right answer, with the correct answer. And I think that is, I kind of cover that in the book, in the whole gray area. I think that that causes a lot of strain and stress, the desire to know when it just can't be known. Mm-hmm. So did you sense the same sort of contradiction in that question?
What I took him to be getting at was that that he understood you to be saying that when the decision is really close, you don't need to sweat it because it probably doesn't actually matter that much. If it's genuinely a very close decision that might even hinge on information that we don't have, yeah, then maybe it just doesn't matter that much. Where he's saying maybe making the decision correctly in real time at the table doesn't matter that much, such that you don't need to like worry after the fact or you know, punish yourself after the fact for getting it quote wrong. But that the process of trying to solve those gray area questions is one of the ways in which you improve your A game.
Yeah. And I think I said that in the book, but you know, by all means do the analysis and I strongly agree that the process of analyzing and going through that is a key part of getting better. Mm-hmm. But the thing I caution about in the book is that you need to let a lot of people, I think, would benefit by letting go of those discussions, say 3 or 4 cycles sooner, mm-hmm. you know, and it's really a subtle point, but I totally agree that that process of analysis is, you know, key.
Yeah, I think it is the kind of thing where if you can do it in a detached sort of way that doesn't cause you pain, then it's a valuable process. But if it's going to result in you just, you know, beating yourself up over and over about the hand, I mean, maybe it's more helpful to analyze other people's gray area yeah. situations than to analyze your own, where you don't have the same emotional attachment to, you know, wanting to either prove that you got it right or you beat yourself up for getting it wrong.
Right. Yeah, you said it just right. I mean, anytime if somebody actually does some amount of meditation or anything where you're consciously observing your thinking, then you get better at recognizing when your mind has just spun off into an area that isn't really doing any good and when your mind is actually doing valuable work. And that's really the line I'm talking about. You know, if you and I were to just sit down and analyze hands, you know, especially when you're with somebody else, it's very easy to stay focused on valuable thinking work. Okay. But then our individual minds off on their own might be thinking about those same hands the next day in that way that's unprofitable.
Right.
It doesn't do any good. And that's really what I'm talking about. And that in itself takes a great deal of awareness to recognize, okay, I'm lost in the sauce. This is, I'm thinking about this hand at this time is not doing me any good. And then having the ability to pull yourself away from it. Mm.
Yeah, that one thing that I've found helpful in those situations when I feel like I may have made a mistake while I'm playing or I'm kind of questioning the way I just played a hand, especially obviously if it resulted in me losing a big pot. And it's been helpful to me knowing that I have, for instance, a blog or earlier like the 2+2 forums, that I had some place that would be the appropriate time and place to do a further analysis of the hand, so that I could tell my brain at that time, let's yeah. just table this, and there's going to be an opportunity to analyze it. This is not the best time to try to do it while you're still sitting here trying to focus on playing the hand that you have now.
That's a fantastic way to look at it. Compartmentalize.
Next question, I'm going to summarize and abridge a bit because it was kind of long, but it comes from Matt, who says that Elements of Poker is mostly about improving your own mental game. And he says, I could kind of imagine a companion book that's called Elements of the Hustle, which is all about how to make your opponents perform worse, helping them play their C game more often, helping them make bad quitting decisions, coaxing them into playing stakes over their heads on short money, making them play emotionally, etc. And most of the people that I've known whose profits did seem out of proportion to their skill at the actual play of cards were almost always deriving that edge from being great hustlers rather than being incredibly studious disciples of Tommy. Not to go all color of money on you, but I really do think it's unlikely that the best pure card players are the most profitable people in poker. And of those people, it was often the assholes rather than the nice guys who were getting the disproportionate money. So what I've always puzzled about is what's the relative value of A, improving your ability to play the card game, B, improving your Elements of Poker-esque attributes, and C, becoming a better hustler.
Well, that's good stuff. The premise he's going on is that the goal that we share in common is making the most money. Mm. And from that premise, everything he says makes sense. You know, it won't be me that's writing the book about specifically the hustle stuff about, you know, throwing people on tilt and everything. Not because I think that's a bad idea. I think that if the objective is to make as much money as possible, then every tool in the tool belt should be examined and find out which ones fit and which ones work and all that. That's, you know, everything from, say, giving false information during a hand, which is not something I try to do, doesn't mean it isn't a great and valuable tool in somebody else's hand. So all of that is fine if the objective is to make the most money, and that is what we sort of pretend is the objective or specifically feel is the objective, depending on the person. But my outlook is is that the objective is to be less unhappy and more happy as the top thing. And so it doesn't seem like that's really what we're talking about a lot of the times, but that's where I'm coming from. And so when it comes to how I play and what I do at the table, there are situations. I mean, I used to be so good at ribbing that I had to stop because I was just like crushing people, you know, and I knew exactly what to say at the right time to do all that stuff. And I used to talk, you know, constantly. And so I do know where that's coming from. And it's fun. And it's fun for the ego and make more money and everybody's all upset. And, you know, but that's just not who I am anymore. That's just not where I'm coming from anymore. So it's very easy for me to forego opportunities that might be more profitable for me for the sake of just maintaining my happiness. And so when I put forth these ideas in the book, even in the book, I'm not saying, okay, you should go do this. I'm saying that if the premise is happiness, then this is what it looks like.
So that makes me think of the conclusion of the book where you talk about how it would be difficult to design a better factory for producing a certain type of mental anguish than poker. And that, you know, poker can also be a good training ground for dealing with frustration. I'm curious how, I guess, literally you intend that. I mean, do you really look at poker, and has it been what poker was for you as an opportunity to mentally train yourself for bigger frustrations that come along in life?
Absolutely. And, you know, when I wrote that was in 2006 or 2007. And so I'd been meditating like 3 or 4 years. And yeah, one of the reasons I was so excited about that concept and putting it in the book is because I was absolutely living it every day. And so I was equating undoing my frustration over a bad beat as being the same as undoing my frustration over being stuck in traffic. Mm-hmm. You know, it was all the same. And the idea that every time we are faced with something that makes us unhappy or that we wish was a different way, that is an opportunity to practice the act of not needing things to be changed all the time and to just accept things exactly how they are in front of me. You know, if my steak comes and it's cold, well, I'm now sitting here with a cold steak. That doesn't have to be a bad thing. And it really does all totally go together. And now I've been doing been doing it for another 6 years or so. And so now one of the things I'm kind of excited about writing in Painless Poker is I'm expanding on a lot of the topics that are in Elements of Poker that didn't get expanded on, but I'm expanding on them in the context of characters. We're sitting around talking. So there's a 25-year-old internet pro and a 50-year-old crazy Asian. And so a lot of these topics are getting expanded on a great deal. But one thing I'm happy to be writing about is what I really go through when I play poker now. You know, what is really going on in my mind. I go through a session and kind of give real detail about what it is like to literally be meditating while I play poker. And that is one of the ways I look at poker now when I play, is as a meditation. So I've gone, you know, about as far as you could possibly go with this whole idea of melding meditation, mindfulness with poker, and seeing it as an opportunities to, you know, smooth out the rough waters all through my days. And so I'm not even proposing that anyone else would even do it like this, but I do feel like in a sense I'm a reporter. So I've put myself in this laboratory and I've been doing this for years, and I'm kind of reporting back and saying, okay, just matter of factly, you know, this is what it looks like from my perspective.
Do you feel like that's something that's intrinsic to the game? Like anyone who plays poker for 10 years is going to deal better with frustration than someone who doesn't? Or do you think that it's necessary to, not necessarily to have read your book exactly, but to have made some active attempt to use poker as practice for dealing with frustration?
I think for people who take poker, it's some people are going to use the frustration of poker itself as a drug. Okay, so you know, so let's say they're not happy with their work life, they're not happy with their home life, and they go to play poker as the escape itself. Okay, so whatever pain and recurring patterns of frustration and anger and everything they have at poker, that's why they do it. Okay, that's like what it provides for them. So they're not going to, that type of person is not using poker in a self-reflective way to grow themselves as a poker player or as a person. People, other people, generally speaking, it's more likely to be the professionals or people or amateurs who have read the books and tried to take a professional mindset, is that those people, and by that I mean, you know, you and I, are naturally more self-reflective. You know, some people are just that way. And so people that are just naturally more self-reflective, that are already asking questions about themselves and probing a little bit deeper, that then poker can be just like the ultimate place to do that, because there's time and we tilt and we say things and we feel things that we don't feel, you know, that strongly in other parts of life. My good friend Doug, who's a professional, he brought this point to me, and he said that it's like the fact that we're sitting there so long, basically in a form of solitude and enduring all this stuff, if a person happens to already be self-reflective and is trying to elevate their awareness about their own mind and stuff, yeah, poker's going to do wonders in that way.
I try not to be too sentimental a person. You know, the world changes and that's that. But I do find myself missing the days before smartphones, when poker was had much more forced time, where you just sat around and thought or didn't think or talked with the guy next to you. Do you miss that about poker 10 years ago?
Well, it's still like that when I play. I mean, what do you mean by the cell phones?
Oh, it's just less time. At the average poker table at the places I play, there's X percent less conversation. And, you know, the time that I have between hands is not time when I'm sitting in a chair with...
Oh, because people. You're more likely to be engaged with your device. And other people.
I am, but I can leave that in my room if I want. It's just like my neighbors are more likely to. And I feel like the conversation is just generally not quite as good as it was 10 years ago.
Yeah. I would agree with that. I don't know if it, some of it is, you know, I think a big part of it is that the games are tougher.
Yeah.
You know, you have more people on average who are there to really play seriously. And then that means they are less likely to talk, whether they're, you know, doing mum poker or not or whatever. The games are just quieter, especially at the 5-10 level, you know, 2-5 even. It does seem like there's less conversation in general. I would agree with that. I'm not quite sure why.
Yeah. I actually, you might be supporting one of my points. I got into a disagreement with a great guy who's a much better player than I am too, and has played a lot more live poker than I have. And I just hypothesized that the reason the games were a bit less friendly these days, it wasn't because the new generation is morally bankrupt or anything like that. I think that people underestimate that it's just because the average player is better, and better players, you know, for whatever reason, are less devoted to friendly chat than
weaker players.
Not always, but just somewhat more.
Yeah, I totally agree. As you were talking, I was picturing myself playing the 5-10 game at the Rio at the World Series. And it's like, yeah, when a pot comes up, everybody's watching. You know, it didn't used to always be like that. You know, people were just doing other shit. But it's like all eyes are watching these players play, you know, on the turn. And it's like, wow, these guys aren't missing much. So, yeah, I think we're right.
Okay, great. Thanks. Take that, Keith. Are there any projects you'd like to tell our readers about? We'd please plug anything that you'd like to plug.
The book I'm working on, Painless Poker, as I've already mentioned, I'm very excited about it. It has actual characters in it with long range art, and the bulk of the book takes place at a fictional setting called the Painless Poker Clinic, which is a clinic run by me, and there's 7 poker players there, and each of them represents classic archetypal poker personality, lifestyles, and playing styles and attitudes. And each of them was beamed in to the clinic at their moment of greatest pain. And so every one of them has a story to tell about, you know, what they were doing when they got beamed into the clinic. And one of the guys is a real hard case, very unfriendly guy. And his story is, it is the most painful story I could possibly concoct. And I've been working on this with my friend Alex, who's no stranger to pain. And we've been having a lot of fun concocting the characters and stories. But it's turning out to be just a wonderful format for me to discuss, rather than just tell, you know, to discuss these topics in much greater detail with actual people. So it's much like the conversations I have with my clients. So I just want to say I'm really psyched about that. The standard question I get is, when is it going to be done? And my standard answer is that it's going to be done in about 2 years. And I've been saying that for 3 years. So you do whatever you like with that information. I'm having so much fun with it right now. I kind of hope it takes a few more years.
It's funny. That's the sort of question that I would check myself before asking you, because, you know, like having read so much of your stuff, like I would feel like I was begging for you to conform to my schedule, or that I was somehow unhealthily attached to the near prospect of this book or something. I would I'm surprised that people actually ask you that question. You know?
Well, now here's something kind of fun. I've told the plot line. It has actual plot. It has an ending, and you know, it's a big showdown in the hand, and you know, it's kind of exciting. And
is it a royal flesh beating four of a kind?
I don't know. I can't remember. But when I've talked to people about it, especially some, you know, I know a lot of people outside the poker world now, and a couple of people said, oh, you know, this is a movie. You know, this would be a movie. And one friend of mine said that that Hugh Laurie should play me in the movie. that would be pretty good. And so as I kick this idea of the movie around, I'm in the act of it while I'm writing this, learning a lot about how to write fiction. You know, I'm really going to school on this. And it's just so much fun. And Jay Rosencrantz, you know, he went to school to write fiction. I mean, he took writing, and now he's really into writing with the micros and all that, right? You know about all that. Yeah. And Jay and I are pretty tight. And I already told him, I said, you know, I'm going to write this book and then just turn it over to him for the screenplay, if it's ever going to like go to movie. And I'm already thinking about that as I write it. It's like, okay, I want to lay this out in such a way that, you know, Jay would have a lot of fun turning this into a movie. So who knows? You know, anything could happen.
Do you think there's potential there for a non-poker audience? I mean, is this a book that would be of interest to people who aren't poker players?
I'm so glad you asked that. At this time, okay, the first couple of years of working on this book, at that point, it was basically a giant file of stuff. I was sorting through it and fleshing it out, much in the tone of Elements of Poker, even though I didn't want it to end up like that. But now it's moved to where I'm really working on it with the idea that a non-poker player could read it. And I say that hesitantly, because I'll kind of believe it when I see it. I have a couple people already in lined up that are going to read it that don't play poker and have promised to not learn how to play poker in the next 3 years.
I can add my mother to that list.
Okay. Well, you know, but we'll see how that goes. You know, I don't really quite know yet, because right now there is a lot of poker centric, you know, material in there, but I'm, even with the hands, I'm writing them in a way that they just fly by in one paragraph, just a lot of little things I'm working on. So the answer is, I really don't know if it's going to be palatable or marketable to non-poker players, but I am moving in that direction.
I don't want to pry too much into your personal finances, so feel free to tell me you'd rather not answer. But I'm curious, because you've referred to yourself as being mostly a professional writer now, and you've mentioned like working on this book for 3 years and maybe having two more years in it. I mean, does it seem feasible that you're going to get 5 years salary out of the book?
Well, you are on a roll with these books. Okay, the answer to everything is I have this wife. She has a job. And she makes enough to support both of us. So anything I make at this point is, you know, basically gravy. And I still am taking on the occasional new client, even though I'm not officially taking on, you know, bulk clients. And I do hourly coaching with existing clients. And incredibly, both my books are still selling, you know, enough that real money comes in. No, not huge money, but, you know, some money. Now, back to my projected earnings from this book and all that, it is possible, if everything goes well, that let's say that that I put the value of my time at $100,000 a year. Okay, it is conceivable that I could make $500,000 from this book over, say, the first 3 years of its lifespan. So yeah, the numbers do come out roughly like that, to where it could, in, you know, after the fact, turn out to have been a good financial play.
But that's not your primary concern.
Right. My primary motive for writing this book is to just pass forward some of the things I've learned, because I feel very fortunate to have gone through what I've been through and be at this point where I'm at right now. And there's nothing that says I won't, you know, dip back down somehow. But right now, everything is good. And I get a lot of gratification out of being able to help people who are, you know, interested in hearing these things and about how I sort of went from being a total derelict to being somewhat disciplined. And that's really where I get my personal joy. And that also is what keeps me going on the project during the some periods when I feel like, okay, you know, what the hell am I doing here?
I'm glad that you mentioned the coaching, because it made me realize that I had actually missed a listener question, which is, because you're not currently taking on students, do you have any past students that you would now recommend as a mental coach?
Actually, yes. One in particular, well, Joe Tall. I don't know if he's even into coaching right now, but I know he's done a lot with some of his clients that has really helped. But there's a guy named Eric Strenquist. He is a client who I coach specifically on how to coach people on mental stuff. So that's his whole thing. And I've spent a lot of time with him, and I really believe that his heart is in the right place, and he has a lot of skill and a lot of compassion. Yeah, he's really good. I've been very impressed with how he talks to his clients, you know, because that's what we talk about. He tells me about what he's been doing, and really impressed with him.
Cool. Well, thanks so much, Tommy, for for coming on here to answer these questions, but I mean more so just for writing this book in general. I mean, one thing, I think Nate had a similar experience to me rereading this book. There were certain things where I was like, oh, I got that from Tommy's book, or just kind of things that had entered my lexicon or my general thinking about poker that I didn't realize until rereading your book, that the book was the initial seed for me thinking about those things. And I do feel like, you know, just as you said, poker has done for you. I think the combination of poker in your book and some of your other articles has helped me to have a better mental approach to other things in my life outside of poker.
Excellent.
Yeah, it was intensely familiar to me in a way I wasn't expecting. It's really become the stuff of a lot of my thought at the poker table. So thanks.
I really appreciate you saying all that. And I just want to say, I think your show is great, and it's a great service you provide. And I'm really, really glad it's going well and that people are checking it in and listening to you guys.
Well, you have to kick it off. You were one of our very first and most prominent guests.
Still most prominent. That's one of our most common messages we get, is please bring Tommy back on the show. So thanks for coming back on the show.
Okay, well, you know, I'm just sitting around here writing, so we can do this every week if you want. That's fine with me.
But I'd say you could probably expect to hear from us in the not too distant future then.
Okay, sounds good.
Fantastic.
Thanks, Tommy.
Thanks, Tommy.